This is Your Call. I'm Angie Carter, filling in for Rose Aguilar today. Welcome. It's Your Call's Friday Media Roundtable. In the second half of today's show, we're going to be looking at the Trump administration's continued decimation of U.S. immigration courts. Isabella Diaz of Mother Jones looks into the firings of some two dozen immigration judges and court employees so far, and how that's going to affect the massive backlog of literally millions of cases. Right now, though, we are headed to L.A., where estimates are that January's fires took out at least 11,000 homes. You may have seen the many stories covering how toxic the devastation has been, not just the debris on the ground, but right down into the soil. It's not the vision of prime real estate with the massive cleanup still underway, but in just this short window, home lots are already on the market and already selling over the asking price. Now, who's behind that cash? Reese Tebow of the Washington Post is on the line. He's the West Coast correspondent for the Post, and he's been following recovery from the fires in L.A., especially related to housing, which is right on point for this. Here's an excerpt from his March 14th story. Dissonant real estate listings promise blank canvases for dream homes alongside photos of wreckage. For every available lot, one agent said, there are at least 10 interested buyers, offers mostly from developers and builders, and like catastrophes before them, the fires have also prompted a swarm of opportunists, small-time land speculators, and large-scale developers peppering owners with texts, calls, and letters taped to their properties, offering to buy the land in cash. Now, we've seen this before. The same pattern in Maui, for example, left residents fearful that speculators would make their neighborhoods unaffordable and unrecognizable. So it may have been predictable in L.A. as well. How is this going to play out? What does it mean for longtime residents there, too, that want to rebuild their communities? How is the area's continued status as fire zones play into the picture? We're going to get into that with Reese. Welcome to Your Call, Reese.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. Well, we've got a tradition on Fridays around here. We ask our guests to talk about an article or a piece of journalism that you've read or heard or seen in the past week that you liked and that you would like to recommend. So what impressed you this week?
I love that. I've got a Bay Area recommendation. There's a podcast called Ear Hustle that your listeners might know. It's based out of San Quentin Prison and tells stories about what life is like inside. And the most recent episode is about how birthdays are celebrated in prison.
Oh.
And, you know, like all the best Ear Hustle episodes, it's moving, it's hilarious. It's eye-opening, and it has this this original birthday song in it that has been stuck in my head for days. So I would recommend that.
You're not going to sing that for us.
I think listeners should just go hear it for themselves. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for that. So now we're going to get to your Post article. It frames our whole conversation. The title is Cash Offers Only After LA Fires, Scorched Lots Are Selling Fast. Now, you start out with an Altadena resident who lost a home there and could not face rebuilding. So tell us an example about how that's going down for him.
Yeah, you know, this family is in a position that unfortunately hundreds of families are in, where they were underinsured and faced with the prospect of losing their nest egg, you know, their most valuable asset. They felt like they needed to recoup as much money as they could as quickly as possible. You know, they were under financial strain, and they decided to sell once they saw all of the interest in these burned lots. And so, you know, for them, they kind of cut bait early and got what they could and are moving on, despite, you know, a lot of local pressure to hang on to those lots in these kind of early tumultuous months.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing people who initially decide that they're going to try to stick it out and being persuaded by all these calls and texts about we can give you X amount of money for that lot?
Yeah, I think that's starting to happen, and will only increase as time goes on and it becomes clear just how long a process this is. But there are certainly a lot of people who are, you know, on the sidelines just waiting to see how the market plays out, and who are definitely seeing, you know, offers come in above asking and thinking, now, you know, that could be me.
So, of course, the big thing is who's buying up the properties. And I mentioned the situation in Maui. You cover the same thing where it's this mix of small investors and big investors, speculators. So how is that working out in both Altadena and Pacific Palisades?
Yeah, we've got a mix of people involved so far. I mean, there are the sort of larger development groups. There are kind of small time out of area developers, some out of state companies that see this as an opportunity to buy low, turn the houses around quickly, and sell for a profit. And then you've got kind of one-off, some families who maybe were looking to get into these areas and couldn't afford it before, and see this as an opportunity to, you know, either buy a starter home there or make a small time kind of individual investment. So we're seeing a real spectrum play out so far.
And you know, it's very easy to characterize this as big, bad, evil corporations with all their money scooping up all the land and chasing out everyone there. It's a lot more complicated than that, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, there's a certain degree of, you know, normal real estate activity here. I mean, to the extent you can describe this extraordinary situation as normal. But yes, that's, you know, it's really complicated.
You mentioned the phrase gentrification by fire. Talk about that.
Yeah, so this is increasingly common dynamic where there will be a community devastated by natural disaster, in this case fire, but it happens with hurricanes and tornadoes and other disasters. And after the disaster is over, you've got this scenario where a bunch of homeowners are suddenly without housing, and they're faced with this long, expensive process of rebuilding. Mm. And for a lot of people, that's just financially prohibitive, either because they were uninsured or because they were underinsured or just because, you know, they can't stick it out for the 2 to 3 to 4 years. And so what ends up happening is it drives longtime residents out of the community, and people with the means to make that work come in and replace them. And so it's a sort of accelerated gentrification.
And part of it is geographic. There's Pacific Palisades, which was a much more moneyed area compared to Altadena, which is more middle class. You talk about Stephen Lamb, who's in Altadena, and he's an example of the lowballing that's going on there.
Yeah, that's right. So there was an executive order signed by Governor of California prohibiting unsolicited lowball offers that come in and are way below what the market value should be. And that's what Stephen Lamb felt like he got from this company. He felt like his land should be worth at least twice what they've asked. And so he heard that, and he basically hung up and he said, these guys are sharks. But I think it's going to come down to the homeowner. You know, I think there are people who might face a little more financial pressure and who decide that that is worth it for them. And I think that's what a lot of community groups are really concerned about, is that some of these lowball offers will prey on people who are in really vulnerable situations.
That's really interesting. Does the law specify exactly what lowballing is?
It doesn't, and that's sort of one of the push points here. But you know, there's really no kind of precedent for this, right? So that's one of the big questions.
I know we have some listeners who've been through their own problems with this. Of course, we've had the fires in Oakland, the North Bay, near the San Mateo, Santa Cruz County lines. If you're listening and can share your experience with either your attempt to rebuild or being bought out, or being convinced of one after considering the other, our phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-TALK is our phone line, 866-798-8255. You can also email us yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be switching topics at the bottom of the hour, so if you'd like to get your call in, I recommend doing it now. So let's talk more about the government, and that's the local government's weighing in as well. Do they officially prioritize rebuilding over selling, or vice versa?
Well, the government wants to, the local government, the city and the county, they want to make rebuilding as easy as possible. And so there's been a whole lot of talk lately about cutting red tape. And one of the ways that they say they're doing that is by prioritizing permits for properties that engage in what they're calling a like-for-like rebuild. That's where you've got an already approved floor plan, because that's what the county approved for your house that burned down. And you take that and you say, I'm going to build that exactly the same with some, small modifications to bring it up to current code. And they will prioritize those properties. And so that's one of the ways they're trying to kind of expedite this situation. But, kind of zooming out, there is a tremendous pressure, both internal and external, on elected officials to get this recovery moving as fast as possible. You saw that when President Trump visited Los Angeles earlier this year, and you can continue to see it in the way the city's especially extremely wealthy residents are lobbying City Hall.
With the prioritization of, building back like for like, and at the same time, you have speculators with a great deal of money who don't need that input from the local government, can essentially build whatever they want. It sounds like it would be an uphill battle to, for example, create some shadow of the old Altadena, families, people of moderate income living next to people of a healthier income. It sounds like what you can end up with is a bunch of mini mansions or even mansions next to smaller homes that did rebuild like for like, and rather than a mixture, more of a disparity.
Yeah, these communities are never going to look the same. They just can't. But the grassroots groups that are forming to try to keep land in local hands are hoping that by preventing as much as possible developers from purchasing large swaths of property, that they can at least preserve the kind of community spirit that existed, even though the houses won't look the same, and some people will move. They're hoping to through kind of a variety of strategies, at least keep properties more affordable. And that's by starting land trusts, and by lobbying for local regulations that, prevent the large scale sale of property to any one developer or individual.
You don't want to reduce this equation down to just money. Obviously, there's so much more at play. And the people who do choose to sell aren't necessarily cash thirsty. In some cases, there are emotional components with, I just can't look at this neighborhood anymore. I need to get out of here.
Yeah, I mean that's a big part of this. There's this heavy sense of tragedy over both neighborhoods, and anyone who's been affected and is making the calculation whether to stay, whether to go, they are weighing money, of course. But there's also the prospect of living in a neighborhood that is full of constant reminders of what happens. And for people who, may have narrowly escaped the flames, there will be trauma triggers, around every corner, where they may have evacuated at the last moment. And so the emotional component to this is huge, and it cuts both ways, because at the same time, you'll have longtime, lifelong residents who are committed to staying and will stick this out no matter what, because this is their home. So you see it kind of on both ends.
You talked to one doctor who faced that and ultimately decided to leave. What were his considerations?
Well, I think anyone's considerations are just that. You just sort of say, I can't picture being here for another 5 years and weathering construction and the kind of constant reminder of all that was lost. And at the same time, you have the financial component. And so that's gonna be the main drivers for many people.
As I mentioned earlier, this is I mean, clearly, this is not California's first experience with big fires. And I'm wondering if any lessons from rebuilding after earlier fires are consciously being looked at, and perhaps some moves toward rebuilding codified or at least considered that are just based on the history of what we've already learned from fires. Where do you see that playing a part?
Well, I think there's a lot of push and pull here, because you have the conversation about where to build homes and whether homes should be built in areas that are especially vulnerable to fires. Some places have burned before and will burn again, but there is a tremendous amount of local pressure around that discussion from homeowners who want to rebuild their houses where they once were. There's a lot of kind of information sharing. There's a sort of loose network of city officials across California who have gone through this before, and I know that LA leaders, council members have traveled to Paradise, for example, and talked to officials there about, you know, what they've learned, not just from a kind of policy standpoint, but also on a kind of community emotion level. And so there is a lot of that exchange happening. But the kind of long-term policy changes, those are still to come, and those are fights that I think will be really contentious and will continue to play out for years.
Yeah, and a new consideration is that insurance companies are just plain pulling out of California. They don't want to look at the regulation. They, you know, what they're allowed to do or not to do in the fire zones, they're just leaving, and that's more of a consideration than it's been in the past.
Oh, it really is. And I was talking with one resident earlier and asking him, you know, whether he has seen in the immediate aftermath a sort of tale of two recoveries, differences between Altadena and the Palisades. And he said, you know, some of that, sure, but what he's seeing more of is a tale of two insurance companies, or really more insurance companies, meaning that it more so differ, your situation will more so differ, not by zip code, but by your insurer, that will make the biggest difference, whether you can rebuild, whether you have to move. And that dynamic will only become more pronounced in the years to come.
I want to go to the phones, where we have a caller, Forrest, in Santa Cruz. And Forrest, you've had friends who've gone through these same decisions.
Well, I live just north of Santa Cruz, and live at a farm that was right at the edge of where the fire ended, but I lived at several places in my adult life that burned, and probably about 40 of my closer friends lost houses in the fire.
Wow.
And you know, one of them is getting close to being built back, but it's taken almost 5 years. There was no sense of the response, at least down here, being a disaster thing that needed timeliness. And what ends up happening is that older people don't want to battle the county of Santa Cruz, which has a very Byzantine, slow, and expensive permitting process for any piece of property, much less something that's in the coastal zone. And so do you really want to spend, you know, a few years dealing with this bureaucracy to get a place back? And then a bunch of my friends were in an area that had a special, like, code exemption that had been created a while ago that kind of allowed these homesteaders to stay. And the county doesn't want to allow any building going back there because there's not a road going in and out. And anybody who knows the fire area knows that the amount of roads that were built to do the logging and the removing of the redwoods is just astounding. And it's a move to not build a road when they could, because they would rather not see these people that had a code exemption to have, you know, it had a special status. And it just seems like, in general, that the county really prefers very wealthy people to be the people that rebuild, because that are expensive houses give a long-term tax break, a tax boost to the county. And
Forrest, I got to let you go at that point because we're so tight for time, but you have brought so much there to unpack. Forrest, thanks so much. Let me get your thoughts on that, Reeves, on the many things he brought up there.
Yeah, I really appreciate that call, Forrest, and I'm so sorry about your friends and their homes. I think you raised the point about fires driving out elderly residents, and I want to hit on that because that's a huge deal, and we're seeing that already here in the Palisades and in Altadena. The other part about that is, if you've owned your home for a long time and maybe you've paid it off, you might not have home insurance, and so if a fire comes through and burns it down, then you're really stuck. And so I know that's a situation a lot of people here have found themselves in.
Well, obviously, this is a beat that you're going to stay on. So tell us what developments you're going to be watching for.
Well, you know, I think it's there are these in every kind of life cycle of a natural disaster, you have these milestone moments. And, you know, we'll start to see building permits being issued, and that will be a moment. And we'll start to see structures going up, and that'll be another moment. And along the way, we'll be tracking the movement of residents and whether they decide to stay or to go. And we'll be watching how that changes the makeup of these communities, and then how all of this reverberates around the local politics and the state politics. I think, you know, this is an issue that California will continue to face, certainly. And we will be watching to see how many lessons the state and other localities learn.
I'll be glad to have you back when you have more of that under your belt. Thank you so much, Reese.
Thank you so much for having me, Angie.
Reese Thibault. He's West Coast correspondent for The Washington Post, and we've been talking about his article, Cash Offers Only. Stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. Then we're going to move on to the draconian cuts at the immigration courts, weirdly at odds with the Trump efforts to purge immigrants from the U.S. That's coming up next on Your Call. Stick around. This is Your Call. Welcome back to our Friday Media Roundtable, and Mother Jones reporter Isabella Diaz joins us now. We'll be talking about her piece, The Entire System Will Collapse Inside the Purge of U.S. Immigration Courts. It details an oddly contradictory situation in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump has deployed ICE to remove as many immigrants without proper paperwork as possible, to the point he's also sweeping up and deporting U.S. citizens and people who are here legally. So why at the same time is the administration disemboweling the very court system that could expedite the process he wants underway? This is the judges, the administrators, and other workers at the Executive Office for Immigration Review. That's EOIR for short. They actually do the work of adjudicating who should stay and who should go. Isabella, welcome to Your Call. This is odd, to say the least.
Hi, thanks for having me. And yes, I think that's appropriate to say. And like you put it, so clearly those immigration judges, you know, maybe people might think that they are your traditional independent, you know, kind of judicial figure, but they are in fact employees of the EOIR, which is the branch of the Department of Justice. And, you know, there are around 700 or so immigration judges across the country, and they hear something like an average of 500 to 700 cases every year. And I think, you know, the current national backlog of pending cases is at 3.6 million. So you can imagine how critical a role they play, and they are indeed a key piece of this very deportation machine that the Trump administration is hoping to max out in pursuit of their mass deportation agenda. And that kind of contradiction in what they are doing with the immigration courts was something that the people I spoke with for the story really pointed out. And some of them even suggest that, you know, this might actually be by design, and that the idea is to just completely skip immigration courts and the due process and try to swiftly remove more people without giving them a day in court.
Mm-hmm. Well, this story as we go on is clearly going to be another stress fest. So let me back up into something more positive. Every Friday, we ask our guests to talk about an article or piece of journalistic work that you read or heard or seen in the past week that you liked and would like to share with everyone else. So is there anything that impressed you this week?
Yeah, I'm afraid I wish I could recommend something lighter, actually. So this might be a failure on my part, but something that really has been on my mind is, you know, the stories we've have been hearing about Venezuelan migrants who have been deported from the United States and sent to this mega prison in El Salvador. And I think, you know, there was a piece in the Washington Post this week that was, the headline was, for four Venezuelan friends, the Alien Enemies Act cuts short the American dream. And they really, the reporter was able to track the family members and friends of some of these, you know, more than 200 Venezuelans who were deported to El Salvador and directly to a prison, and, you know, kind of confirmed that they had no criminal records. You know, these were people with no real evidence that they had ties to gangs and you know, were kind of being swept up in this because of their tattoos, essentially. So I think this was a really important piece of reporting that I really hope that people read. And yeah, while it's not very uplifting, I think it's really critical that we keep in mind what it's being done currently.
Absolutely. Good coverage is so vital to that. So thank you for that one. So let's go back to our main story with your Mother Jones piece. A graph in your article shows more than 3.5 million cases that are pending, let alone the ones that are already underway in the courts. So obviously they've exploded in importance over the past decade or so. How many cases are the individual judges handling per day? You said 500 to 700 a year. In the life of an average judge, what are they looking at every day?
Right. So, you know, it's really depending on where the judge is. You know, there's some of the most backlogged immigration courts in the country are actually in California. I think, if I'm not mistaken, San Francisco has the most backlogged court in the state with more than 128,000 cases pending. So, you know, these judges are sitting every day from 8 a.m. until like 4 p.m. or later, hearing case after case. You're talking about dozens of cases, and they have very little time, you know, to do anything else other than that. I actually, you know, talked to one of the fire judges, Carrie Doyle, who had been assigned to this new court in Massachusetts that just opened last year to alleviate the backlog in the state. And, you know, she didn't even have a chance to hear a single case. She was still in a probationary stage, and she was let go along with 12 other immigration judges who had all been part of this incoming class appointed by the Biden administration. And, you know, she described how excited she was about the opportunity to do this very consequential job. You know, she was gonna really help this immigration court. And now, you know, as a result of just this 13 or so firings, we are talking about, you know, almost 10,000 cases that will no longer be heard this year. And we'll just, you know, join this ever growing pile of cases that are just awaiting.
Mm. Let's talk about those individual cases. It would be valuable to kind of walk through for people how a case goes through the system. So you have an individual, they're apprehended, they face deportation. Tell me what they face from there.
Yeah, so, you know, usually, you know, someone will come into the country and you know, they might present themselves to a border agent, they will be issued a notice to appear in court at a later date. And because of, you know, this exactly this backlog we've been talking about, that court date might be years in the future, you know, 3 or more years in the future. And then in the meantime, you know, some people are allowed into the country and they cannot miss the court hearing because that would get them in trouble. Or, you know, some people are sent into detention centers. And, you know, they might have some preliminary hearings in the beginning where they're just setting up for what, you know, a master or an individual hearing where, you know, some of these people have actual real claims for asylum and other forms of protection in the United States. And the immigration judges are really the ones who have that final word on whether those thousands and thousands of immigrants who come before them, if they should be allowed to stay in the United States and be granted some sort of protection, or if they should be ordered deported. And you know, the longer that people remain in the country without seeing a judge, it means the longer they are not granted the protection that they have earned, or that they, you know, aren't removed as fast as they could be.
This is a parenthetical question. I'm just curious. There's so much about the way our government works where it makes a great deal of difference to have money. If I am someone who is a potential deportee and I am, let's just say I have a lot of money or I have friends with a family with a lot of money, am I going through exactly the same system that you just described, or is there a way to sidestep that? Are there private courts, private judges? I'm just curious about how that works, or is everybody in the same boat?
You know, my sense from having reported on cases in the immigration courts over the years, that the one thing that can make a difference and be beneficial for someone's case is to have representation, which is I think the one defining you know, aspect that gives people an actual chance to fairly fight their, you know, deportation orders or to win an asylum case. And unfortunately, for most people who are in detention centers, they, first of all, they are not entitled to representation, and it's very hard to have access to counsel when you are sitting in a detention center. And so we know that, you know, it really makes a world of difference to have access to legal counsel. And then, you know, when you what we are seeing now, this, like, you know, Trump administration pushing for this expedited fast-track deportations that will just bypass any sort of immigration, you know, judicial review. You can, you know, imagine that a lot of people with very, you know, real claims will just be deported without having a chance to make their cases. And I think that is, you know, everyone should be concerned about that. We could, you know, we would probably wish that we were given, you know, if we were in that situation, we would all wish that we had a fair day in court.
Well, because this is underneath the DOJ, it's a part of the of that branch of government. Does the president have the authority to say we're going to move out the adjudication judges and streamline the process and just send them away, send these people away, and we don't have to adjudicate their case? Does he have the authority to do that?
You know, it's with, you know, the Trump administration, they've been really pushing, you know, the boundaries of what we understand to be some of the limits of presidential authority. And you know, this use of expedited deportations, it, you know, it has been employed in the past, and certainly in his first Trump first term, he tried to rely on that even more. But traditionally, it was used, you know, for recent migrants who were within 100 miles of the border. And what the Trump administration is doing now, and it certainly will, and already has, in fact, prompted legal challenges, is expanding this to essentially apply to anyone in the interior of the United States who cannot show proof that they have been in the country for at least 2 years. So that is, you know, a very broad extension of this power. And you know, I think every immigration lawyer would tell you that this raises a lot of concerns and the potential, you know, for issues like racial profiling and for wrongful deportations of permanent residents and even U.S. citizens.
Let's go ahead and get the phone lines open. I know that we have people listening who've had their own experience with this, a family, a friend, an employee who is suddenly under the shadow of being deported, being seen as or actually is an immigrant who's here without papers. Very much like to hear your questions and comments, and especially your experiences or the experiences of that person you know. How does this story touch on your impressions of all that? Our phone line is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. You can email us as well, yourcall@kalw.org. Isabella Diaz is with Mother Jones, and she has written the story on this, and that's what sparked off our conversation. 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. You're also welcome to check in if this is not your experience, but you have questions or comments on the whole situation. We'd like to hear that as well. So we're looking at the cuts, Isabella, and up to 28 people, as you write, as of early March, have been terminated. 15 immigration judges, 8 supervisory assistant chief immigration judges, and 5 senior managers. Can you put that in context of how big a group this is to begin with? Is that a critical number?
You know, I think it certainly is significant. And I think, you know, in the past, when administration changes, you see, you know, some immigration judges are like, oh, it's not entirely unprecedented. I think what sources shared with me is like, is the scale of this. This has been kind of unprecedented in the sheer numbers. And I think in addition to those, you know, 28 people who have been terminated as of early March, I also later talked with the union, the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers, representing some immigration judges. And in addition to those fires, we also saw another 18 immigration judges and who are retiring early or just decided to resign. And then another 66, you know, professionals at the immigration courts, though some of these people who support the work of immigration judges and you know, do translation and things like that, who also decided to leave EOIR. So, you know, that just brings that number of 10,000 or so cases that will no longer be heard this year, you know, to a much higher figure.
It's interesting to hear about that union representation, because in 2020, during the first Trump administration, immigration judges were stripped of their collective bargaining rights. So it sounds as though they haven't entirely lost union representation. Tell me what their status is with that now.
Yeah, so in his first term, the Trump administration tried to decertify the National Association of Immigration Judges, and they were successful at that. And the National Association of Immigration Judges, I think, if I'm not mistaken, is currently trying to recover their status. Mm-hmm. So that was an example of how the Trump administration is trying to meddle with the immigration courts, and we know that in the first term, you know, the issue of the morale within the agency was very much an issue. There was dozens of immigration judges in those first 4 years of the Trump administration that quit and very publicly, you know, left the bench because of the ways in which the administration was, you know, trying to make their jobs harder. They imposed quotas on, you know, how many cases they needed to decide every year. You know, they kind of put limits on how these judges could just, you know, administrate their own dockets and you know, take cases that weren't priorities from their dockets. And so I think we are probably going to see something similar this time around again. I know from some of the fired judges I spoke with that they definitely sense that there is a chilling effect. There's that sense of like among the remaining judges of like, you know, are we going to be next? And I think there's very much an expectation that there will be more mass firings and or reassignments, perhaps.
I'm curious about some of the individual people that you talk to, and I understand, obviously, we're not going to give name and phone number here. These are people who very much need to be anonymous. But there's starting to be some stories coming out of all branches of government from people who have been fired. Fired federal workers have come together with a website called WeTheBuilders.org, and that's where they're telling their stories. And what we're finding out there is, in many cases, they open an email, they find a one-line message that says, your services are no longer needed, or we've determined that your job is over, and then there's an attachment that says, here's your termination package. Are judges and the judicial employees there, are they getting anything more detailed than that, or is that same sort of, don't ask any questions, you're out the door?
Yeah, it was, you know, from the judges I was able to connect with and that have been, you know, kind of brave in coming out publicly about their terminations, some of them were just sitting in court, you know, observing another judge's proceedings or, you know, going about their workday. And then they received this email from the new acting director of EOIR, Circe E. Owen, and it just, you know, we just said that their employment was no longer in the interest of the agency. And you know, in the cases of some of the supervising, you know, officials, they were, you know, long-term career officials within the agency that had decades of experience together working within the Department of Justice. And they were let go despite of having glowing performance reviews with very little, you know, explanation as to why. You know, and again, the immigration judge that I mentioned earlier, Carrie Doyle, she, you know, she went on LinkedIn and she talked about her termination and her frustration with it. And she said that the only thing she could think of is like, you know, what those judges had in common is that they had been in her class, is that they had been appointed by the Biden administration. And she, you know, kind of took that as a sign that this was a political firing. And I should say that the EOIR, the agency, they you know, declined to comment on any personnel issues. But we've also seen that the director of the agency has since issued some policy changes, including some that would essentially make, you know, immigration judges at will employees and make it much easier to fire them, specifically the ones who are still in that probationary phase.
Have you been able to, I know this is incredibly difficult, have you been able to talk to any immigrants who are stuck in the system, who are awaiting all this? I'm very curious whether they get word of what's happening here, whether they understand what just happened to their ability to move through the system. Do you know of any awareness on that level?
Yeah, I mean, I think I haven't talked to any immigrants recently regarding this, but I think, you know, we know from reporting out there that even prior to these firings, you know, some people in Texas, California, Florida, some of the states with the backlogged courts, that, you know, these people are looking at 3, 5, 10 years to have their cases resolved. And you know, we imagine in a moment right now where we are very much in a heightened, you know, immigration enforcement kind of landscape, that, you know, that creates a sense of more insecurity for people who haven't, you know, had their cases resolved. So I can only imagine that, you know, they are probably aware that this will just further complicate what is already, you know, kind of an impossible situation. And again, I think really we should keep in mind that many of these people do have very legitimate claims and should be considered to be allowed to stay in the United States instead of being deported to potentially, you know, dangerous, harmful situations.
Yeah, yeah. Talking to Mother Jones reporter Isabella Diaz, her article that we're talking about is "The Entire System Will Collapse Inside the Purge of U.S. Immigration Courts." And we do have the phone lines open at 866-798-8255. Maria in San Francisco, you're on the air with us. What would you like to say?
Yes, good morning. Thank you. This is a very disturbing trend, and I'm just wondering, where is it all going to lead? What is the intention, I mean, of this administration? Is it just to, like, completely destroy the judiciary and that we now will have an inevitable authoritarian rulership? I mean, what could be the intention of all this? I'm just really just blown away and just wondering, where will this all lead? Where will we be if there's no stoppage? If there's nothing left, if Congress can't do anything, Senate's not doing anything, there is no judiciary, the Supreme Court is not doing anything, where will we end up? That's my question.
I appreciate that, Maria. And to put that in context, we were talking earlier, Isabella, about how this is a different issue than what's happening with the judges that are, you know, underneath the Supreme Court, the Ninth District and the local districts. These are people who are working under the Department of Justice. So perhaps you can address Marie's question in both of those aspects. What's the potentially worst situation here versus what might be the worst situation with the judicial branch of the government?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a good answer for that. I feel like we are seeing this attacks on all sorts of directions, and I think it is again kind of bringing back to that issue I also mentioned earlier that we are seeing with the use of this wartime statute to deport people from the United States. I think those are incredibly problematic kind of uses of presidential authority, and they are bringing up raising questions of whether we are already facing a constitutional crisis, and I think we should take that very seriously. I think with the immigration, some of these immigration issues, it will inevitably go into litigation and go to the courts, and I guess we have to somewhat hope that the lower courts and some of the appeal courts will still kind of hold the fort, like the DC Washington DC judge is currently doing, the one who Trump has asked for his impeachment in this case of the deportations of Venezuelans. And I think that's an example of someone who is doing their part in preventing that legally dubious and potentially unconstitutional acts be performed by the administration. But it really is a troubling trend, I agree.
Let's have for your last question, because we are a little tight on the clock. What is still pending from the Trump administration? And that's in terms of, we're seeing what's already happening with these judges. We're seeing what's already happening with the deportations. What else is he trying to do? Things that are perhaps under review, executive orders that have been blocked or haven't taken effect yet. What's he up to now?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of, I've also kind of reported on how the Trump administration is trying to undermine birthright citizenship, and there have been for the children, the U.S. born children of undocumented immigrants, as well as temporary visa holders, and that certainly has gotten some coverage, as it should be, because that would be an incredible departure from the Constitution and legal precedent and tradition in this country, but. Maybe people haven't been following as closely, and recently the Trump administration has doubled down on that, and they have been they took the case to the Supreme Court. Essentially, they are trying to get the court to lift some of the lower court's decisions that have temporarily blocked the application of his birthright citizenship order across the country. And so if the Supreme Court sides with him and allows for those blocks to be lifted, we would be seeing his executive order essentially taking away birthright citizenship from certain U.S. born children, taking effect in several states in the country. So I think this should be again alarming, and we definitely need to keep following the developments on that front as well.
Tell me your next story. What's coming up?
I'm actually currently also looking into connecting with the families of the Venezuelan migrants who have been deported to El Salvador, to the infamous mega prison there, and just trying to shine a light on, how these people really didn't deserve to have that happen to them.
Well, have you talked to any of the families yet?
Yes. And, you know, they are really feeling a sense of like hopelessness. They for days didn't know where their loved ones was and ended up, you know, finding on social media, TikTok and Facebook through videos, they were able to identify their relatives, you know, who were having their heads shaved and being held in this prison. And so, yeah, I think, you know, it really is one of the most troubling stories I have ever followed as an immigration reporter. And that's saying a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I appreciate the work you do. I'm sure our listeners do too. Isabella Diaz, reporter with Mother Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking about her article, The Entire System Will Collapse Inside the Purge of the U.S. Immigration Court. Thanks to Therese Tebow of The Washington Post. He was our earlier guest this hour discussing buy-ups of burned lots in the wakes of fire in the Pacific Palisades and Altadena neighborhoods. He's going to be staying on that story because his work is West Coast coverage with a specific emphasis on housing. So we'll see how those areas develop as well. Now, if you missed any part of those two conversations, it's all going to be online. To listen to past shows or sign up for your podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can find us on iTunes, where we would like you to give us a review if you have a moment to do that. Email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Andrew Stelzer helped produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. If you can stick around for Monday's show, this has been our Friday Media Roundtable. And on Mondays, we bring you our look at the environment with our climate series. So stick around for that one as well. Or come on back for that one. Have yourself a weekend in the meantime. I'm Angie Cuero. Thank you for being here today. This is Your Call.